It's a great place to come visit first.
The new administration puts an emphasis on Central America, immigration, and the Panama Canal. A look at Secretary of State Marco Rubio's first diplomatic trip from a Catholic perspective.
We know that porn causes harm and that it leads to more sexual dysfunction to our children.
Protecting our children. What's at stake in the Texas pornography case being decided now at the United States Supreme Court?
We want to give our very best. And what can we do more glorious as a human person than to sing our prayers?
Teaching appreciation for the oldest forms of Catholic music right from early grade school.
Sisters show up for the Super Bowl who aren't really huge football fans the rest of the year.
Nuns and bishops take sides and get into the spirit of the big game. Super Bowl in the convent and our annual Bishop's Bet. It's all here on EWTN News In Depth.
Today, it's one of our strongest economic partners, certainly in the hemisphere, and an important catalyst for so much trade and commerce that happens in the United States.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking in Panama on his first international trip. His tour through Central America shows Trump is setting his priorities on our closest neighbors. His administration is trying to balance building relations with countries in the Western Hemisphere and putting pressure on initiatives it says hurt the interests of the United States. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado, in this week for Catherine Hadro. It's been more than a century since the Secretary of State made Latin America the destination of a first international trip. Rubio's visit puts the region in a new spotlight, but it also shows Trump's priorities, cracking down on immigration into the United States and loosening China's ties on Central America. It was a busy 6 days for Rubio as he toured Central America, visiting El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and the Dominican Republic. His first stop was Panama.
And we didn't give that to China. We gave it to Panama. We shouldn't have given it to Panama. But Panama, as you know, has violated the agreement, totally violated the agreement.
Much of Rubio's visit to Panama concerned the Panama Canal and Trump's claim that it's now under the management of China. The United States built the canal in the early 20th century and until 1999 operated it as well. It serves as a vital link for global trade and generates $5 billion in revenue every year. Trump says Panama broke its deal of neutrality when it, quote, gave China the canal. Panamanian President José Raúl Mulino denies that claim.
Existe.
There seems to be some confusion between the channel and the ports that needs to be cleared up. The adjacent ports, all of them, have no involvement in the administration of the canal, none whatsoever.
Trump's call for America to retake the canal has been met with condemnation, both from Panama's president and its people. But China's growing influence in the country is undeniable. In 2017, Panama became the first country to sign on to China's Belt and Road Initiative, a massive project that seeks to connect East Asia and Europe through railways, pipelines, highways, and maritime routes.
It's basically the Chinese Communist Party's imperial vision to turn the economic orientation of the whole world away from Washington and toward Beijing, away from the West and toward the East. And usually with the Belt and Road, you find that once you make that deal, you either have trouble paying off the loans over time, and oftentimes you'll find China's military come knocking at your door because they want to start basing or have some sort of presence in your country.
A Hong Kong-based company operates seaports at both ends of the waterway. They're not state-owned, but are subject to China's national security laws. Michael Sobolik, a senior fellow with the Hudson Institute, says that could pose serious issues for the United States.
Imagine that China forward deploys either some sort of military ships or cargo ships that have missiles in them, or ships that they just literally use to pre-position and block canal access. So the danger is, what if the U.S. military either is denied transit through the canal by Beijing, or what if that transit is even at least delayed? That is an unacceptable scenario, and it is a crisis scenario because we have vital interests within the first island chain in the Indo-Pacific.
Rubio did not repeat Trump's call to retake the canal, but did tell Mulino that his country would face action if it did not cut ties with China's Belt and Road Initiative.
The Memorandum of Understanding of 2017 on the Silk Route, the Belt and Road Initiative, will not be renewed by my government.
On his last day in Panama, Rubio turned his focus to another top priority for Trump, immigration. And before boarding a plane of his own, watched a deportation flight with dozens of immigrants depart for Colombia. In El Salvador, the focus on immigration continued when Rubio received an unprecedented deal from current President Nayib Bukele. The country would not only receive Salvadoran deportees who illegally entered the United States into its massive prison system for a fee, but, quote, any illegal alien in the United States who is a criminal from any nationality. It is unclear whether the U.S. will take up the offer.
We'll have to study it on our end. There are obviously legalities involved. We have a constitution. We have all sorts of things. But it's a very generous offer. No one's ever made an offer like that. And to outsource at a fraction of the cost, at least some of the most dangerous and violent criminals that we have in the United States.
On Wednesday, Guatemala's President Bernardo Arevalo promised Rubio his country would increase deportation flights carrying migrants by 40%. These immigration agreements highlight Trump's effort not only to increase deportations from the U.S., but to stop migration at its source.
We also understand from the United States that most people who come in here have as a goal eventually making it to the United States. So you could say that at a certain point, our border doesn't begin at Texas or Mexico. It begins a lot before.
To discuss the Secretary of State's visit to Central America, we're joined by EWTN contributor Alberto Fernandez. During his time working at the U.S. State Department, he served as a diplomat in both Nicaragua and Guatemala. Thank you so much for joining us, Alberto. In a piece for the Wall Street Journal, Rubio said his trip signifies an America's first policy. He writes, for many reasons, U.S. foreign policy has long focused on other regions while overlooking our own. As a result, we've let problems fester, missed opportunities, and neglected partners. That ends now. Why do you think the United States is turning to its regional neighbors in this administration in particular?
Well, I think it's various points. Number one, there is a sense, as Rubio said in that piece, that we've spent a lot of attention, a lot of time and money in, let's say, less productive parts of the world, say the Middle East, and kind of neglected our relationships in this hemisphere. While we neglected our relationships in this hemisphere, we've seen a tremendous growth in Chinese influence and interference in the hemisphere, and also seen, of course, the rise of hostile states to the United States, the three that Marco Rubio and President Trump have mentioned at past times, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
Do you think the United States will actually retake the Panama Canal, as Trump says? Are his comments on China's role and control of it legitimate?
Well, I think, you know, the president's remarks are pretty clear, but also knowing his style of negotiating, it seems like it's a maximalist position where the other part is going to have to negotiate. And certainly that seems to have happened as a result of the Rubio visit. There have been a couple of things that Panama has done to kind of change the equation, and there could very well be more.
And when you mentioned that style, how do those comments impact relations with Latin America and the broader region?
Well, I mean, it's always, how is that received? I think it's received seriously, if not literally, as a famous article about President Trump said. Certainly it's serious when the most powerful man in the world has something to say about you, and you need to take it seriously and see how you react.
Well, let's turn to El Salvador and that proposal to keep America's inmates in its own prisons. What do you think of that deal? Is it unprecedented? Could it actually happen as a collaboration between two countries? I know there are some experts who say it's neither legal nor ethical.
Well, I mean, we're talking about illegal criminal aliens. In other words, we're talking about people who have committed a serious crime in the United States, been convicted, and who are supposed to be deported. So I think it may be a gray area that we actually haven't addressed in the past before. Now, there have been in the past when different countries here or there arrangements made between the United States and a partner to house or to detain people. But you're absolutely right. This is kind of uncharted waters. But as I said, we're not talking about American citizens. We're not talking about people who have a right to be in the United States. They're both serious criminals and people who are supposed to be deported.
Well, something to watch for sure. Much of Rubio's trip was overshadowed by news from Washington, notably shuttering the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, which Rubio says he now runs as part of the State Department. Do you see that impacting our relationships with Latin American nations, where USAID's work really was a feature of soft power in the region?
Yes, but it could impact for the good as well. I've served, especially in Guatemala, I remember that USAID's activities were a lightning rod, and there was a broad sense in the society that at least some of the things that they were doing was kind of politically tinged social engineering from the United States. In other words, that USAID and the Americans had a heavy hand with their Latin American partners. And so many people will welcome a different AID that focuses on cooperation and humanitarian assistance without that heavy political, politicized, maybe leftist orientation.
Now, Rubio is the son of Cuban immigrants and a fluent Spanish speaker, not to mention a practicing Catholic as well. How do you see that shaping his trip, shaping his impact in the region?
Well, I think both of those are really important elements, and I would add two more, and that is, of course, he was a U.S. senator for 14 years who worked a lot on Latin America. And, of course, he is, like me, from Miami, and, you know, many people have called Miami the capital of Latin America, which has, you know, as you know, Monse, vibrant exile and immigrant communities, and you get to know Colombians and Venezuelans and Nicaraguans and whatever. So I think all of those things working together give Secretary Rubio a unique and I think a very powerful and positive perspective.
While in Costa Rica, Marco Rubio called the governments of Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba enemies of humanity, obviously influenced by exactly what you just described with his experience in Miami. He particularly was denouncing Nicaragua for attempting to eliminate the Catholic Church or any entity that threatens the regime's power. How do you hope that the Trump administration will support religious freedom in Nicaragua?
Well, Nicaragua was a fascinating case because it has weaponized migration flows, made it a funding source for itself, directed against the United States. And that happened during the Biden administration, and it suffered no penalty at all. I mean, Nicaragua is still has access to American markets. And so this regime is not just oppressing its own people, it's openly taking actions against the United States. And so a reaction from Washington is overdue. And I would just mention that, you know, when Marco Rubio says enemies of humanity, of course, he's probably also referring to the infamous Sandinista hymn, which says, "We fight against the Yankee, the enemy of humanity." So I think there's a little bit of poking there, he is, of the Sandinista regime.
That's really interesting context for a lot of our viewers who I don't know actually have that memory of the Sandinistas. Thank you so much, Alberto. It's always great to have you on. Your insights are really remarkable. I hope that we'll be able to have you on again.
Thank you.
A Nicaraguan bishop whose imprisonment sparked a global outcry is breaking his silence in an exclusive interview with EWTN News. The Daniel Ortega regime accused Bishop Rolando Alvarez of treason because of his outspoken opposition to religious persecution in Nicaragua. After months of confinement, he was only released from prison when the Vatican negotiated his release. He is now in forced exile in Rome, where he told EWTN's Paola Arriaza he still has reason to hope. Here's Bishop Rolando Alvarez on the record.
A year after being forcibly exiled to Rome, Nicaraguan Bishop Monsignor Rolando Alvarez has broken his silence. The prelate, who spent 17 months in detention, first under house arrest and later sentenced to 26 years in prison, was accused by Daniel Ortega's regime of conspiracy and treason. His release was the result of Vatican-led negotiations with the Nicaraguan government.
I always thought of and believed in my freedom. Always believed in my release. When? I don't know. I didn't know. But I always hoped to be free, and I insist. What sustained me was prayer. The fact that I am here today, giving this interview from the beautiful Pontifical Commission for Latin America, can only be explained as a supernatural act of God. There is no human explanation for why I should otherwise be able to be here with you in this moment.
Despite being forced to leave his homeland, Bishop Alvarez continues to feel united with the Nicaraguan church.
I do not feel exiled, but liberated and in the diaspora. And in the diaspora, faith always grows and hope is strengthened.
During his imprisonment, international organizations such as the United Nations expressed grave concern over his physical condition and called for his release. In 2023, just months after his incarceration, U.S. Congressman Chris Smith demanded proof from Nicaraguan dictator Daniel Ortega that the bishop was still alive.
How was your health when you arrived in Rome 1 year ago, and how are you feeling now?
I've had a year of recovery, certainly in terms of my overall health, but also a year in which I've been finding the inner peace I so desperately needed. To put it in quantifiable terms, I arrived at zero. Zero in all my psychological, psychiatric, emotional, affective, sentimental, moral, spiritual, physical, and semantic capacities. Zero. Today, a year later, I can say that I am 90% recovered.
While the Nicaraguan government has released several clergy, many priests, religious and lay people remain behind bars. Religious persecution in the Central American country has profoundly impacted the local church, forcing more than 400 citizens into exile, according to Bishop Alvarez. Since the expulsion of the Apostolic Nuncio in 2022, the regime has intensified its crackdown, dissolving the Jesuit order, seizing church properties, confiscating the major seminary of Matagalpa, and most recently taking over the monastery of the Poor Clares.
How is the situation in Nicaragua for the local church?
Yo siempre manejo en mi bolsillo.
I always carry in my pocket the pastoral letter that the Holy Father addressed to the Nicaraguans on April the 2nd of last year. And in that letter, the Pope exhorts us, in a tone that is very familiar and very much our own, to believe in and trust divine providence, even in those moments when, intelligibly, we cannot understand what is happening. In other words, in those times when hope turns to darkness, we must firmly believe that God is at work in human history and in the history of nations. And I am convinced of this. That is why I am a man of hope, and I believe that my people, my nation, is a people of hope.
In Rome, Paola Riaza, EWTN News in Depth.
For more on the Bishop Alvarez interview, go to an extensive article at our partner, Catholic News Agency. There's much, much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth, from the Supreme Court to the classroom to the Super Bowl.
Is sexuality just something for recreation, or is there something more meaningful here? We're human beings, we're not animals, we're called to live a better life.
Should there be a law to limit pornography access to children? We examine a case before the High Court and talk to an expert who specializes in protecting young people from harmful social media. A modern Catholic school brings back ancient Gregorian chant. A look inside the music room ahead.
I know who I'm rooting for, but I'm not going to tell you, Bishop Johnson.
All right, you kind of gave it away there.
And backed by popular demand, our annual Super Bowl Bishop's Bet. A friendly wager between the bishops of Kansas City and Philadelphia a little later on EWTN News in Depth.
It's obvious that porn is not good for anyone, including adults, but if we're going to have it in this country, if we're going to allow for porn to exist, we have to at least protect our children.
How young is too young to have legal exposure to pornography? That's the subject before the United States Supreme Court, Free Speech Coalition, Inc. versus Paxton, a Texas case argued before the justices last month. Reporter Mark Irons was outside the high court to capture the sentiments of those who came to express their concern. And he spoke to victims who talked about their porn addictions beginning at a very young age. Mark tells us what's at stake.
One of those biggest assaults that we have against our children is pornography online.
Saturated with screens, TVs, computers, tablets, and smartphones, children can easily be exposed to sexually explicit material whether they seek it out or not. As president of the American Principles Project, Terry Schilling, a father of seven children himself, has a warning.
If you're a parent in this country and you have children, porn is absolutely something you need to be monitoring and making sure that you're protecting your children from.
Recent studies report some children see pornography as early as 10 years old or younger. Taylor Mathoka says she was 7 when she was first exposed, and a 10-year addiction followed, impacting her mental health.
I became depressed. I had a lot of anxiety. I couldn't trust anyone. I isolated. I felt so much shame.
And with more than 20 years of experience in combating sexual exploitation, including time as a police investigator, Marcel Vandervoort, the president of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, says pornography is detrimental to society.
From sex trafficking, from a child-on-child sexual abuse, prostitution, with all of these interconnecting pieces of sexual exploitation, pornography is a consistent and a coherent thread in all of that.
In recent years, 19 states have passed laws requiring pornographic websites to verify the age of visitors through ID upload.
Verify your age online for buying alcohol, tobacco, nicotine, gambling, all these adult entertainment things. We verify your age, except for porn. That's not right. It's not acceptable.
The pornography industry, represented by a group called Free Speech Coalition, has pushed back, describing a Texas state law as extraordinarily burdensome and invasive, effectively deterring adults from accessing legal content.
The issue now comes before the Supreme Court, and a major case will be decided that could protect children from pornographic websites.
Last month, during oral argument in the case involving age verification in Texas, justices questioned an attorney representing the porn industry.
You dispute the societal problems that are created both short-term and long-term from the rampant access to pornography for children.
Justice Kavanaugh, that is a complicated question.
Do you agree that there is a compelling government interest in keeping obscene materials from minors?
Yes. Unequivocally.
But the porn industry says age verification isn't needed, arguing parents can put filters on computers or phones to keep children from accessing porn. Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioned that.
Kids can get online porn through gaming systems, tablets, phones, computers. Let me just say that content filtering for all those different devices, I can say from personal experience, is difficult to keep up with. So, and I think that the explosion of addiction in to online porn has shown that content filtering isn't working.
The Supreme Court case will be decided this summer and could have broad implications. During oral argument outside the court, a rally cry to protect kids from porn. Taylor says exposure to pornography stole her childhood and prevented her from living the life of a typical little girl.
I was 7, 8 years old. I should be thinking about birthday parties and, playing with stuffed animals and Barbies. But instead, my mind is warped and thinking about the videos and the violence that I was watching. You know, first it started out of curiosity.
An attorney with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation says the porn industry lacks accountability.
And I can tell you, this is an industry that just simply doesn't have the will to step up and create safeguards and guardrails for its own dangerous content.
Advocates for age verification tell us this isn't about banning pornography, but making sure basic protections are in place.
It goes to where the pornography is being produced and disseminated, and it forces those people that are releasing this smut onto the world to verify that they're not giving it to children.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
To give us further insight into the pornography age verification case at the Supreme Court, we're joined by Claire Morrell, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Her area of expertise is big tech and how to protect children from social media's negative influences. She's the author of the forthcoming book, The Tech Exit, a practical guide to freeing kids and teens from smartphones. It comes out in June. Claire, thank you so much for joining us. Give us a sense of this case. Why did the Supreme Court agree to take it, and did oral argument point in any direction of a potential outcome?
Yes, absolutely. The court took up this case because now over 19 states have passed these laws, and the last time that the Supreme Court considered an age verification law was in 2004. That was over 20 years ago, in a completely different era of the internet. And so I think that the justices, and this was demonstrated in oral arguments, were very interested in reevaluating age verification laws and their constitutionality in light of the vast technological changes we've seen in the last 20 years. In 2004, in the last case when they heard an age verification law was Ashcroft versus ACLU, smartphones and social media didn't even exist. And so the facts have very much changed. And I think the court then was eager to take this up. I mean, more procedurally, the reason they took this is because a Texas age verification law was originally enjoined in a district court in Texas, but then the Fifth Circuit overturned that injunction and upheld the law as constitutional. And so then that led to the appeal up to the Supreme Court and their interest in taking this on. And I was very encouraged by oral arguments. I felt like 7 of the 9 justices seemed to be strongly indicating that states need to be able to legislate in this important area to protect kids online, and seem to be willing to apply a lesser degree of scrutiny than we've seen in the past than was the case in Ashcroft versus ACLU, which was strict scrutiny, which is the highest constitutional hurdle to overcome. And so they all seemed very willing to try to apply some lower level of scrutiny to allow states more flexibility in this area.
And it's an interesting divide that we're seeing with those 19 states that do have age verification protocols. It's a divide in the country that shows that the debate is robust for the Supreme Court to weigh in. Claire, at the center of this case is whether or not the protection of minors really is a state issue. Is the government responsible for protecting children from pornography?
It's a complicated question. I would say ultimately, most people would agree that parents are responsible and they are on the front lines. But I think, as has been clearly demonstrated in this case, and the reason behind states bringing laws in this area, is that parents with filters has not been enough. That has been the status quo of the last 20 years. And unfortunately, the rates of pornography exposure and addiction are just exploding. And it's because in this smartphone, social media era, a parent doing everything they can with filters simply is no match for pornography in the ways that it's so easy for a child to stumble across. Over half of teens are exposed accidentally, means they're not looking for it. They're coming across it through social media. And often these filters, they can't filter out the content inside of apps. They can't necessarily filter in-app browsers. There are ways to connect to the internet through these applications. And so it's very difficult for a parent to oversee. And as has been acknowledged for years in precedence in protecting children from obscenity, there is a compelling government interest. We recognize that there are societal costs and harms to pornography exposure. And in today's day and age, if a parent does everything they can, another child with a smartphone can just easily lean over and show a child pornography. And so individual families and parents aren't enough. And that's why states are saying we want to come to parents' aid and provide this critical layer of protection to back parents up. So it is, I think, an area that states do have a responsibility to protect our children and coming alongside parents to help them do so.
Now, protections for sexual content and pornography are based on free speech law. Many people are fearful of the effects that restricting access to pornography will have on other groups that have been targeted for speech restrictions. Are these worries well-founded? Is that actually a real fear?
No, this is a very narrowly tailored law. If you read the law, the kinds of sites that will be targeted are pornography websites, that they have to have over a third of material that is deemed harmful to minors. And if you read that material harmful to minors, it's clearly talking about obscenity and indecency, which there's an entire standard for in our Supreme Court precedent. They have defined how we judge what obscenity is. And this is really not a content-focused restriction. It's not saying these websites even have to take down certain types of content. It's all about access. And they're trying to say adults can access this speech, but children cannot because it is harmful to them. And it has long been upheld that we can consider obscenity to minors as a more protective standard than what we would say is appropriate for adults. And so these laws are specifically just trying to restrict children's access to content on big pornography websites that would be considered obscene as to minors, again, under this very detailed criteria in the law. So this will not implicate free speech in other areas. And most importantly, it won't even implicate free speech in this area. Now, a lot of the content on these websites would be considered even obscene for adults, but that's not what's at issue. They're not saying adults can't access this content. And because our technology has advanced so much, age verification can now be done in ways that is anonymous and private and convenient for adults in less than 30 seconds without revealing any other personal information about themselves to the websites. And so it's not going to be a burden on adult speech in any way.
Now, that reality of how narrow and tailored this is really affects the way that those who are trying to fight porn addiction do their work. A ministry fighting porn addiction recently noted in an exclusive interview to EWTN that these age restrictions just aren't enough. Do you see a different path for protecting children and anyone from access to this harmful content?
I would just echo what they're saying, I think, is that it's such a vast problem. There's no silver bullet solution. We need protection at all sorts of different layers. I think the age restrictions do play a critical role, because if a child were to accidentally click on a link to Pornhub, it means they would not be able to actually get through to see that website's content. And now, of course, the big pornography websites aren't the only way kids are coming across pornographic material. And sadly, it's actually directly on the feeds of a lot of social media apps today. So it's certainly not a silver bullet, and no one is saying that. But what we are saying is that filters and individual parents is not enough. The government can help parents by putting the onus back on the pornography websites themselves to say you can't allow children onto your sites to access this harmful material. And so it is a critical layer of protection, but we need more. And so I'm encouraged that I think this is just the start of policy solutions in this area to try to better protect our kids online from this content.
Well, Claire, thank you so much for your analysis. We'd love to have you back on once the case is decided. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Of course. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Remarks from President Donald Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast this week in Washington top the Week in Review. During two events surrounding the prayer breakfast, Trump said he wants to root out what he calls anti-Christian bias in the U.S.
I'm announcing that I will be creating a brand new presidential commission on religious liberty. It's going to be a very big deal, which will work tirelessly to uphold this most fundamental right.
The president has signed an executive order targeting anti-Christian persecution, though in his remarks, he told the audience he had never heard of anti-Christian bias before. In announcing a series of faith-based initiatives, Trump also said he would reestablish the White House Faith Office and that he had chosen his longtime spiritual advisor, televangelist Paula White, to lead it. White is linked to the prosperity gospel, a belief that faith in God brings material wealth. The president had his first visit from a foreign leader when he invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House this week. The two leaders met during a delicate time in the ceasefire agreement meant to wind down the 15-month war in Gaza. Netanyahu's right wing in Israel is pressuring him to resume the war, while Hamas says they will not release any more hostages until Israel withdraws all of its forces. Trump expressed his support to Netanyahu in rooting out Hamas and suggested the 2 million displaced Palestinians should be permanently resettled outside the war-torn territory in nearby countries like Jordan and Egypt. At a news conference, the president called Gaza a demolition site unfit for habitation and said instead that the U.S. would take over the territory and develop it.
We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal. And I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy. But the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad. This could be so magnificent. But more importantly than that is the people that have been absolutely destroyed that live there now can live in peace in a much better situation because they're living in hell.
When reporters asked Netanyahu what he thought of the president's suggestion, he said it was an idea worth listening to and called it the first original idea that has been raised in a long time. The idea did not go over well with Palestinians. It stunned American allies and other global powers and infuriated the Arab world. Critics called such an expulsion an ethnic cleansing contrary to international law. Palestinians, now living in the worst of conditions, roundly rejected the idea, calling Gaza their homeland.
Dying here is better. It is better than going anywhere else because you have nothing after losing your land, country, and home. Although it is demolished, our homes are worth the whole world for us.
We are deeply shocked by Trump's remarks. He is attempting to intimidate and threaten the Palestinian people with coercion and forced displacement. As Palestinians, we will not leave this land. What they fail to achieve through war, they will not accomplish through political means either.
Many analysts doubt the plan could ever happen, and after his remarks, the White House seemed to suggest that any removal of people would only be temporary while rebuilding occurs. But President Trump restated his vision later in the week, writing on Truth Social, the Gaza Strip would be turned over to the United States by Israel at the conclusion of the fighting. Two federal judges ruled back-to-back against President Trump's day one executive order to end birthright citizenship, a legal principle that automatically makes anyone born in the United States a citizen. A Maryland judge issued a national injunction on the order on Wednesday, and a second judge from Washington State similarly ruled on Thursday, calling Trump's move unconstitutional. The administration is expected to appeal. The NCAA has officially updated its policy on transgender student athletes. Women's sports are now limited to only biological women. That new policy came on Thursday, just a day after President Trump signed an executive order banning biological men from competing in women's sports. Dozens of young female athletes joined the president in the Oval Office for the signing ceremony. In recent years, many women have spoken out against men competing in women's sports as unfair, dangerous, and a rejection of the protections promised to women under Title IX. The Department of Defense will no longer cover the cost for military members and their family members to travel out of state for abortions and fertility treatments like in vitro fertilization. The new memo removes a Biden-era policy enacted after the overturning of Roe v. Wade that sought to ensure troops could access the procedures no matter what state they were assigned in. Many conservative lawmakers who saw the old rule as federal funding of abortions applaud the change. Many feared economic chaos in the United States and in other parts of the globe after President Trump threatened to impose a blitz of tariffs on some of the country's biggest trading partners earlier this week. Trump was on the verge of imposing a steep 25% tariff on imports from American neighbors, Mexico and Canada, but backed down after a steep drop in the stock market on Monday. Both countries also offered enhanced border support to delay the tariffs from going into effect. Canada says it will elect a fentanyl czar to help halt the flow of illegal drugs into the U.S., and Mexico pledged to station thousands of its troops on the border. Tariffs did move forward on China, which retaliated to Trump's 10% tariffs with its own tariffs of 15% against American imports. The Trump administration contends tariffs will protect domestic industries and curb fentanyl trafficking. But many economic experts say tariffs will be a disaster.
I'm very comfortable with how we are moving forward on trade policy, because we have experience on our side. And again, what we're trying to do is save jobs, factories, and lives. That's Trump trade policy.
You know, I think it's a lose-lose. It's just a question of how big the loss. You know, it raises prices, raises inflation. And of course, we've been through a very wrenchy period globally with high inflation. It's been a real problem.
Negotiations with Canada and Mexico are ongoing as Trump holds off on implementing the tariffs until next month. Trump has suggested that levies against the European Union could be next, but the EU is already preparing a response. The attempt to shrink the federal government under billionaire Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency ran into a temporary restraining order from a federal judge late this week. Millions of federal workers had received emails offering buyouts if they voluntarily resigned and accepted the offer by a midweek deadline. But several labor unions challenged the offer's legality, and the judge ordered a hearing for next Monday. Even with that delay, other federal workers were shown the door at agencies President Trump wants to downsize. Protests erupted in Washington and in state capitals around the country as the administration announced massive layoffs at the U.S. Agency for International Development, dismantling the primary vehicle for U.S. foreign aid. The White House accuses USAID of financial fraud and abuse. At the Environmental Protection Agency, nearly 200 employees who work on reducing environmental harms to poor and minority communities were put on paid administrative leave. And the CIA became the first intelligence agency to suggest employees can quit their jobs in exchange for a buyout if they are not responsive to the Trump administration's national security priorities. The White House says this is part of the president's plan to reshape the federal workforce.
We encourage federal workers in this city to accept the very generous offer. If they don't want to show up to the office, if they want to rip the American people off, then they're welcome to take this buyout, and we'll find highly competent individuals who want to fill these roles.
It's one thing to downsize the government. It's one thing to try to obliterate it. And that's what's going on. And that is what is so frightening.
Meantime, an attempt to find out the identity of up to 6,000 FBI agents and analysts across the country who worked on the January 6th investigation also ran into a delay after new leaders at the Justice Department demanded a list of their names be handed over. The acting head of the FBI was accused of insubordination when he refused to do so. In response to a lawsuit filed by the FBI Agents Association, a federal judge has paused movement in the standoff as both sides appeared at a court hearing. Lawyers representing the agents say they fear their clients will become the target of revenge firings, and they say agents' lives and those of their families will be at risk from pardoned January 6 defendants if FBI names are made public. The Justice Department assured the judge that the Justice Department has no immediate plans to reveal names, but could not guarantee what Elon Musk or the White House might do. An update now about last week's tragic mid-air collision between an American Airlines jet and an Army Black Hawk helicopter near Reagan National Airport in Washington. After days of recovery, the bodies of all 67 victims have been retrieved from the Potomac River. The Army Corps of Engineers said Thursday that salvage crews have also now recovered all major parts of both the jet and helicopter. Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board are analyzing the cockpit voice flight data recorders from both aircrafts. In the meantime, Federal Aviation Administration officials announced a slight slowdown of flights coming in and out of Reagan Airport. They say they want to, quote, ease up on the gas and reduce stress for air traffic controllers who are working and guiding planes while at the same time having a front row view of the recovery efforts. In the midst of all that sadness, we'll try to lift the mood a bit with inspiration from a Catholic school.
We're watching these students be drawn into the beautiful timelessness of the church. It's incredible.
Next, learning to perform Gregorian chant, what one school is doing to bring love of church music to its students.
We are an early to bed, early to rise community. So whether or not we make it through the halftime show is yet to be seen, but the first half you will find me on X, live tweeting.
And later, we talk to the nun who spearheads the social media frivolity in Super Bowl in the convent. Last week, weekend, Christians around the world celebrated Candlemas. It's a tradition in which candles are blessed at Mass on the feast day commemorating Mary and Joseph bringing Jesus to the temple and light into the world. The feast officially closes the Christmas Epiphany season. In Pasadena, Maryland, EWTN News in Depth went to a concert on Candlemas, emphasizing the importance of sacred music in honoring our Lord. Rizal Rejas has This Catholic Life report.
It really just connected to my soul. I just felt really lifted up to God.
The beauty of sacred music.
It's my favorite music, actually, Gregorian type of chant that we were hearing today.
Gregorian chant, written over the ages to accompany the liturgy, sanctify the faithful, and glorify God. In celebration of Candlemas, Divine Mercy Academy, a K-8 Catholic school in Pasadena, Maryland, hosted a concert featuring the Baltimore Basilica Professional Choir.
This concert is here for them to really fully realize the very best that they can. We brought these beautiful musicians here to demonstrate to them that they need to do that someday.
The choir performed a number of popular Gregorian chants. And for a surprise performance, students were able to join in as well.
Join us in singing God Have Here Whining, called by Adorers.
These 150-some students started learning how to sing as early as kindergarten, as music is part of their curriculum.
With the little ones, we've focus mainly on the Ward method, just teaching them how to use their body and their voice to sing. And I tell them, if you can speak, you can sing.
Divine Mercy Academy uses what's called the Ward method, a progressive method of teaching children the fundamentals of music so they are able to sing sacred music. The method was developed by musical educator Justine Ward in response to a request from Reverend Thomas Edward Shields, chair of the Department of Education at the Catholic University of America in 1909. By the 1920s, the Ward method was used in Catholic schools across the United States. These are fourth graders knowing what notes to sing after musical director Kelly O'Connor points to a sequence of numbers. Throughout the years, Divine Mercy Academy has asked the director of the International Ward Music Program at Catholic University, Amy Zuberbühler, for guidance. Zuberbühler was impressed by the students' progress. She explained that teaching children about sacred music will have a lasting impact in the future of the church.
In order to have singing congregations, right, you have to do the step-by-step work when they're young. And to have them also have an appreciation of music and what music is.
Parents are also thrilled that their children are learning Gregorian chant. After watching the concert, they are excited to see what their young scholars will be able to perform in the coming years.
I think there's a quiet revolution that's happening, a revolution of beauty. I mean, the modern world is starved for it. And these students are. And so it's just watching their eyes, you know, this morning, they were so dialed in.
Oh, it was amazing. I could see my third grader just singing it loudly. And yeah, it's just great that they're learning these things and understanding, like, this is a way to connect their faith to something beautiful.
Divine Mercy Academy students also showcased their musical talent at their annual spring concert and Christmas gathering. Rizal Rejas, EWTN News in Depth.
Last weekend, we celebrated Candlemas. This weekend, with some Catholic flair, our attention turns to the Super Bowl. Our annual EWTN News in Depth Bishop Bet when we come back.
Bishop Johnson, send me a menu.
Oh, man. Gentlemen. Okay. This This weekend, millions of Americans will tune in to watch the Super Bowl. Many catch the game at a local restaurant, others at a house party with friends. But some football fans watch the Super Bowl from their convent. In 2018, some sisters from the Daughters of St. Paul decided to start sharing fun moments from their community's watch party on social media, and the hashtag Super Bowl in the convent went viral. Now, not only do the sisters continue the trend every year, but other religious orders have started to take part too, sharing hilarious moments and quips throughout the game. Sister Bethany Davis, one of the Daughters of St. Paul, shares how this trend is a fun way to give people a glimpse into community life.
There are sisters in this room that are very clearly here just for the food. And there are sisters in here that are very clearly here just for the commercials. And there are sisters here that are actually here to watch a football game. You know, we spend a lot of time in prayer and intercession, but we also are normal people with normal loves. And I think it's important for people to see that in their feed. And it brings a little joy just to see the sisters being themselves.
Sister Bethany says she and her sisters will continue hashtag Super Bowl in the convent this Sunday. Religious sisters aren't the only Catholics planning to watch the Super Bowl. Since this program launched every year, EWTN News in Depth hosts a friendly bishop wager for the Super Bowl. And for the first time, we have a rematch. I recently asked the bishops from both Kansas City and Philadelphia what's on the line this weekend. Bishop James Johnson leads the Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph, and he's here for the third year in a row rooting for the Chiefs. And Archbishop Nelson Perez from the Archdiocese of Philadelphia joins us once again as the Eagles try to break the Chiefs' back-to-back championships. Gentlemen, bishops, it's so wonderful to have you here with us. Thank you. Bishop Johnson, this is your third time on this segment, always victorious. How does it feel? Are you confident the Chiefs will take the trophy again?
I sure am. I mean, they've shown they can do it again and again, and so it'll be a tough challenge, but I'm very confident in Andy Reid, our coach, and Patrick Mahomes and the rest of the Chiefs. Yeah.
Archbishop Perez, your Eagles are once again facing a big matchup against the Chiefs. Are you excited for this chance at redemption?
Well, I think the bishop and his Chiefs are in for it because the birds are hunting.
Well, I know they've got your prayers for sure. Bishop Johnson, Kansas City kicker Harrison Butker is a devout Catholic and shares his faith openly. But we've seen a handful of sports stars at the collegiate and professional level share their faith. Do you think evangelizing in the end zone can bring fans to Christ?
Well, I'm really encouraged by the faith of so many of the players, and not just on the field, but even afterwards in interviews, how many of them speak about their faith. And so I think it's a great witness of, you know, not covering your lampstand, but putting it out to where it can give light. So I'm encouraged by the enthusiasm that our players have for their faith.
Well, it looks like it's not just the players that have enthusiasm. Archbishop Perez, you're not the only one rooting for the Eagles. The Cathedral of St. Thomas More in Arlington, Virginia, recently underwent renovations, and Bishop Burbidge happened to add a nod to his hometown team in some of his new stained glass. How did you react to that? And is there a friendly competition among American bishops?
Well, when I saw that, I said, you go, Bishop Burbidge. He put the Eagles like this. The Eagles emblem on a stained glass of St. Catherine Drexel. So he was bold and he was right.
Are you praying especially with him for the outcome for this game?
Absolutely, to St. John Neumann and Catherine Drexel. That's we got some power.
That's a lot of power. Bishop Johnson, do you have a patron saint that you're praying to?
Yes, we're Kansas City St. Joseph, so we're going to rely on good old St. Joseph, who's the patron of the Universal Church. So I think we've got him outnumbered there with St. Joseph.
Ooh, that sounds competition. One more time, Archbishop Nelson.
I'm going to add some more saints to my crowd then.
I hear you've got a pretty hefty reliquary too, so.
I do.
Well, not only are bragging rights up for grabs this weekend, as is our tradition, we've come on our program with a wager. Archbishop Nelson, since you're the one returning and challenging, tell us, what is it that's on the line?
Well, when the Eagles win, because they will win, the wager is $500 for Catholic Charities, and then the bishop is going to have to send me some barbecue. If not, I'm going to have to send them a cheesesteak.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Archbishop Johnson, do you accept that wager?
Well, we do. We're looking forward to the cheesesteaks, but if the Chiefs should fall, which is unlikely, we're going to send some Jack Stack barbecue from Kansas City. It's one of the premier barbecue restaurants here, along with the $500 for their Catholic Charities, too. So, but that's pretty unlikely. I'm looking forward to cheesesteaks.
Bishop Johnson, the bishop that I'm on retreat with, asked me to ask you for 2 points, since we're the underdog.
There you go.
You tell them to go back to their prayer.
Well, there we've got it. You've got Philly cheesesteaks and some Kansas barbecue on the line, along with a very generous support for Catholic Charities, which we know is so important, especially now. Thank you both so much for your enthusiasm. We'll be watching to see who wins and make sure we follow up on that wager. Thank you. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us same time next week for more news important to your Catholic life and an update on what happened with the bishop's bet. See you then.